Hi everyone, welcome back to the Ortho Bullets podcast. In today's episode, we cover the topic of juvenile idiopathic scoliosis found under the spine section at orthobullets.com. Let's begin with a quick summary. Juvenile idiopathic scoliosis is a coronal plane spinal deformity which most commonly presents in children between ages 4 and 10. Diagnosis is made with full-length standing PA and lateral spine radiographs. MRI studies are indicated in children less than 10 years old with a curve greater than 20 degrees. Treatment can be observation, bracing, or surgical management depending on the skeletal maturity of the patient, magnitude of the deformity, and curve progression. In terms of the epidemiology, remember that juvenile idiopathic scoliosis makes up about 15% of all idiopathic scoliosis cases. Demographically, it affects females more often than males. And in terms of the anatomic location, it most commonly appears as a right main thoracic curve. In terms of the associated conditions, remember that there's a high incidence of neural axis abnormalities, which may occur in 18 to 25% of cases. Syringomyelia, which is a cyst or tubular cavity within the spinal cord, may be seen. It can be seen in a scoliotic curve without rotation, and it can manifest as an asymmetric umbilicus reflex. Arnold-Chiari syndrome may also be seen. This occurs when the cerebellar tonsils are elongated and protruding through the opening of the base of the skull and blocking CSF flow. There may also be a tethered cord, dysraphism, or a spinal cord tumor. In terms of the classification, juvenile idiopathic scoliosis is part of the early onset scoliosis category. Remember that early onset scoliosis is a broader category including scoliosis in children less than 10 years old, and it includes infantile idiopathic scoliosis, juvenile idiopathic scoliosis, congenital scoliosis, neurogenic scoliosis, and syndromic scoliosis, which may be due to Marfan's or Down syndrome. Moving on to the presentation. Remember that it is important to determine when the deformity was first noticed and any observed progression. One should also obtain a perinatal history. Remember that failure to develop bowel and bladder control by age 3 or 4 may indicate neurologic involvement. And patients are often referred from school screening where a 7-degree curve on scoliometer during an Adams forward bending test is considered abnormal. Remember that 7-degree curve on scoliometer correlates with a 20-degree coronal plane curve. On exam, one should perform a general inspection, which may demonstrate coffeo lay spots, which are associated with neurofibromatosis. There may be leg length inequality, shoulder height differences, truncal shift, weight asymmetry and pelvic tilt, foot deformity such as cavo varus, which can suggest neural axis abnormalities and warrant an MRI. One should also perform a spine inspection. Midline skin defects may include hairy patches, dimples, which may be a sign of spinal dysraphism, and nevi. Rib rotational deformities may be evidenced by rib prominence. One should perform an Adams forward bending test. Remember that axial plane deformity indicates structural curve. One can also perform a forward bending sitting test. This can eliminate leg length inequality as a cause of scoliosis. A neurologic exam should also be performed. This should include a motor exam of both upper and lower extremities. Reflexes should also be checked. An abnormal abdominal reflex is associated with the presence of a syrinx. Remember that gently stroking each abdominal quadrant should cause contraction of the abdominal muscles. One may also note clonus, a Hoffman sign, and a positive Babinski. And one should also perform a gait analysis. In terms of imaging, PA and lateral upright radiographs are used to assess curve severity, and treatment is based on the Cobb angle. A Cobb angle of greater than 10 degrees is defined as scoliosis. However, there is an intra and inter-observer error of 3 to 5 degrees. Also remember that bending radiographs can help to determine which curves require fusion. An MRI is indicated in children less than 10 years old with a curve greater than 20 degrees, even in the absence of neurologic symptoms. This is because one must rule out neural axis abnormalities, such as syringomyelia. MRI is also indicated in the presence of a left-sided thoracic curve. In terms of treatment, non-operative options include observation, which is indicated in curves less than 20 degrees. However, frequent radiographs should be obtained to observe for curve progression. Another option is bracing. This is indicated in curves between 20 and 50 degrees. This is designed to prevent curve progression, not correct the curve. Remember that a relative contraindication to bracing is thoracic hypokyphosis. The specific technique involves wearing the brace 16 to 23 hours per day until skeletal growth completed or surgery is indicated. Operative options include non-fusion procedures such as growing rods and VEPTR. This is indicated in curves greater than 50 degrees in small children with significant growth remaining. This allows for continued spinal growth over unfused segments. Definitive PSF and ASF is performed when the child has grown and is closer to skeletal maturity. Remember that traditional growing rods are associated with greater curve correction and truncal height gain than VPTR constructs. Another option is anterior and posterior spinal fusion. This is indicated in curves greater than 50 degrees in younger patients, and it is required in order to prevent crankshaft phenomenon. Another option is just posterior spinal fusion. This is indicated in curves greater than 50 degrees in older patients near skeletal maturity. This remains the gold standard for thoracic and double major curves, which occur in most cases. And the last operative option is anterior spinal fusion alone. This is indicated in curves greater than 50 degrees. This is best for thoracolumbar and lumbar cases with a normal sagittal profile. Complications related to juvenile idiopathic scoliosis include crankshaft phenomenon. And lastly, with regards to prognosis, remember that there is a high risk of progression. 70% of patients will require treatment. 50% of these patients will be treated with bracing, and 50% with surgery. Remember that very few experience spontaneous resolution, and it can be fatal if not treated appropriately. Now that we've discussed the major points relating to juvenile idiopathic scoliosis, let's walk through some questions to apply what we've learned and get a sense of how the topic might be tested. For the first question, consider the following clinical scenario. A 7-year-old girl presents with early onset scoliosis, and a PA radiograph demonstrates a 90-degree right thoracic curve. Images do not demonstrate any vertebral anomalies. Physical exam shows normal neurologic function in her lower extremities. An MRI of the spinal axis should be obtained to rule out all of the following pathologies except which one. And the answer choices are: choice 1, atlantoaxial rotatory instability; choice 2, syringomyelia; choice 3, spinal cord tumor; choice 4, dysraphism; or choice 5, a tethered cord. The best answer to this question is choice 1, atlantoaxial rotatory instability. Early onset scoliosis is associated with syringomyelia, spinal cord tumors, dysraphism, and a tethered cord, and therefore they must be ruled out with the preoperative MRI. There is no association between early onset scoliosis and atlantoaxial rotatory instability. Early onset scoliosis can be classified as idiopathic, neuromuscular, or congenital. For this patient, without bony or neurologic abnormalities, it would likely be diagnosed as juvenile idiopathic scoliosis. Commonly associated spinal pathologies, even in patients with no radiographic or neurologic abnormalities, include syringomyelia, spinal cord tumor, dysraphism, tethered cord, and Arnold-Chiari malformation. Before considering any surgical intervention, such as a growing rod construct, these intraspinal conditions must be ruled out with an MRI of the spinal axis. The publication by Gillingham et al. Presents a review of the etiology, diagnosis, and management of early onset scoliosis. They cite other studies that demonstrated rates as high as 21% of patients with early onset scoliosis and a normal neurologic exam having occult spinal pathology, such as those mentioned before. They recommend MRI for patients with early onset scoliosis measuring greater than 20 degrees prior to any surgical intervention. Let's also discuss why the other choices are incorrect. Choice 2. Syringomyelia in pediatric patients is typically seen in the thoracic spine and can be diagnosed by MRI. Choice 3. The most common spinal cord tumors in children are astrocytomas and developmental tumors such as dermoid, epidermoid, and teratomas. The gold standard imaging for these tumors is MRI. Choice 4. Dysraphism is a split in the spinal cord that is believed to be the same spectrum of deformity as a tethered cord. The gold standard imaging is MRI. Choice 5. A tethered cord is commonly asymptomatic until adulthood when increased strain on the tethered cord results in neurologic deficits. Occasionally, a tethered cord is seen incidentally on prenatal ultrasounds. MRI is the gold standard imaging for ruling out a tethered cord in both children and adults. A tethered cord frequently requires release to prevent neurologic sequelae. For the second question, consider the following clinical scenario. A 7-year-old boy is referred to your office for evaluation of scoliosis. All of the following are indications to obtain a screening MRI, except which one? And the answer choices are: choice 1, male gender; choice 2, age younger than 11; choice 3, absence of thoracic apical segment lordosis on clinical exam; choice 4, right thoracic curve on an AP radiograph; or choice 5, hyperreflexia and decreased sensation over the bilateral forearms and flanks. The best answer to this question is choice 4, right thoracic curve on an AP radiograph. Male gender, age younger than 11, absence of thoracic apical segment lordosis, and abnormal neurologic findings on clinical exam have all been associated with increased risk of abnormal MRI findings and therefore require screening MRI. Radiographic curve characteristics associated with spinal cord abnormalities which require screening MRI include left thoracic curve, an absent pedicle, and a congenital bar. A syrinx should be suspected when an abnormal abdominal reflex is present. A clinical absence of thoracic apical segment lordosis has been found as one of the highest risk factors correlating with an abnormal MRI finding. A right thoracic curve is typically not associated with intraspinal anomalies. The publication by Davids et al. Reviewed over 2,000 patients who were evaluated for scoliosis, of which approximately 2% had abnormal MRI findings. Factors that correlated with abnormal findings included absence of thoracic apical segment lordosis, followed by atypical curves such as a left thoracic curve, and abnormal neurologic examination. Pain alone or in combination with other findings were not predictive. The publication by Nakahara et al. Reviewed a screening cohort of 472 patients, 3.8% of which had abnormal MRI findings leading to operative intervention. Increased risk factors correlated by regression analysis noted that male gender, age under 11 years old, and abnormal superficial abdominal reflexes correlated the highest. Let's also discuss why the other choices are incorrect. Choices 1, 2, 3, and 5. Male gender, age less than 11 years, absence of thoracic lordosis, and abnormal neurologic findings are all risk factors for intraspinal anomalies when seen in patients with scoliosis. That's all for this review about juvenile idiopathic scoliosis. We hope that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session from OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. As a reminder, you can follow along with these podcast episodes by reviewing the topics directly on orthobullets.com. You can listen to these episodes on the OrthoBullets website or phone app while reading through the topic. If the OrthoBullets podcast has been valuable to you, we'd be thrilled if you consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.